Now, the pandemic changed how and where many of us decided to live, and cities of all sizes have adapted to their changing demographics and economies. With remote workers having more freedom to choose their location, the cities themselves have been competing to attract a class of younger professionals who often tend to be higher-paid white-collar workers. Many cities have invested in urban renewal and new development to provide the amenities these workers are seeking, and some are turning to social media influencers to market their downtowns. Our next guest says these campaigns often leave a lot of people out and lead to lots of different communities trying to market themselves in unique, all in roughly the same way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen your city, big or small, grow and redevelop in recent years? What do you think the identity of your local community is? Have you been part of an effort to rebrand, do placemaking in your community? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David A. Banks is a lecturer in the Geography and Planning Department at the University at Albany, SUNY. He's the author of the new book, The City Authentic, How the Attention Economy Builds Urban America. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into some of the details, I want to throw one more concept onto the table here. This one goes back before COVID, and this went to a lot of cities, the idea that, hey, to rebuild, especially maybe in a post-industrial rust belt type of city, we need to attract the creative class. We need to make an attractive community for these young professionals to come into. Can you talk a little bit about that notion? Because I think it's a key to your argument in the book here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's really kind of the beginning of the story, right? Is that after deindustrialization in the United States, and this also happens in Europe, is that cities don't know where to turn for investment dollars and for in terms of like tax revenue or employment opportunities for its citizens. And so there's really just a policy vacuum there. And then in the 90s, that vacuum is filled by several attempts, but what really sticks, they're all kind of similar, but what really sticks is Richard Florida's 2002 mega hit, The Rise of the Creative Class. And what the argument basically says is, yeah, what you just described, that people, especially high income earning creative professionals, are highly mobile. And for that reason, the way to capture the value that they create is to make them happy and to find fun things for them to do and just generally make them comfortable. And so a lot of cities did that and saw some success. But what happened in a lot of cases was that you kind of got like a tail that wags the dog sort of situation where you make this downtown, or you put a lot of investment dollars in a fun downtown, but the creatives never come. And then you also then have a bunch of small business owners that probably go out of business because the clientele is just not there.
You focus in your work on small to mid-sized cities in upstate New York. I think there are probably comparable stories to be told in similar sized cities here in Wisconsin. In effect, there's this weird paradox where all these communities, they're competing with big cities for people, and they're saying we're going to make our own unique identity, but they're all doing it in many cases, it seems like you're saying, in very similar ways to each other. How has that played out?
Yeah, I actually, one of the longest examples that I have in the book that is not in upstate New York is Milwaukee, because maybe people listening from Milwaukee might remember this. Probably a little less than 10 years ago, there was a design podcast called 99% Invisible that did a show about city flags, like the flag that a city has. And Milwaukee's was rated one of the ugliest because it has
it has everything on it.
Yeah, yeah, it's a whole kitchen sink full of stuff, including another flag, like on the flag. Mm-hmm. Incredible stuff. And so the end of the episode basically like calls for people to like redesign their city flags as a sort of civic boosterism. And in Milwaukee, a young graphic designer makes a flag, and presents it. I think is they calls it like the people's flag, and it gains some traction. But it also gets understandably, there's a pushback because, it's just like it's the creative professional that showed up that likes Milwaukee, but maybe is not from there. I don't recall if he was born there or not. But quickly the flag conversation gets turned into a conversation about who belongs and who gets to say they are part of Milwaukee. And it's a conversation of class and race in that. And it was never really fully, it never really came to a full conclusion as far as I understand. But you know, the that is a little anecdote for the way that cities are rebranding all across the country and in other places around the world, where they recognize that the city has to, in some ways, act like a brand, in that they have to cultivate a personality or a reputation of some kind that exists beyond their borders, and that is both welcoming but also unique, right? And sometimes uniqueness can be off-putting or just intimidating. And so the thing that cities try to strike in their brand management is what I call predictably unique, where you just give a little riff on what is widely kind of understood is just kind of like small town, small city pride.
Social media is a newer part of this story since the original Creative Class book came out. And you see in your book and your research some communities, community leaders, and others trying to become influencers, in effect, and going with a sort of online influencer playbook. What kind of things do you see?
Yeah, social media intersects in a lot of interesting ways. And if we just want to keep it to influencers, there's a few different kinds, right? The one is like your homegrown influencer, someone that becomes popular on their own through whatever mechanism is at their disposal to become popular on whatever social media site they've chosen. And sometimes that can kind of bring everyone with them and raise the profile of the city, right? So one example from around me is, there's a small group of people that do a have like video short kind of series that's on several different platforms, and they've sort of like kind of started merging into traditional media, the newspapers and local television. And in that way, like they're not only like getting the capital region out there, they're getting the they're telling people within the capital region about new things that are happening. Now, another example would be, something like Baltimore, or Washington, D.C., both of those cities are right next to each other, but both of them independently had ideas of like, well, we will go to a talent agency and hire influencers that already have an audience with the kind of demographic that we want to attract, and we will basically pay them to have a weekend trip in our city. And that will heighten the profile of our city in these core demographics that we've identified that we want to attract. And then the third one is something that I called like place-based memes or memes of place. And this is where people make usually jokes, a lot of the times they're self-deprecating about what it's like to live in a place. And in those cases, it'll be like, a common one is like the starter pack, where you say, name of city, starter pack. And then it's just a collection of items, mostly mass market consumer goods that are supposed to reflect the kind of people that live in a place.
We're talking to geography and planning lecturer David Banks about his new book. It's called The City Authentic: How the Attention Economy Builds Urban America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where you live, what kind of growth, what kind of changes have you seen in your area? Do you see this kind of outreach to bring in younger professionals? Do you think it's a good idea? Do you think it's changing your community in ways you're not always on board with? What does it mean to live in the place you live in? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with David Banks. His new book is called The City Authentic, How the Attention Economy Builds Urban America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you see your local community or the state of Wisconsin, for that matter, marketed? How should communities reach out to draw in people? Are you bugged by the way you've seen these things happen, maybe where you live or used to live? What lured you, if you came from out of state, to your community in Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, I don't want to miss this point of your book. You see a lot of downsides to the stuff, the kinds of outreach we're talking about. One of them is, and other people have brought this up over the years, is, okay, if this outreach to young professionals is successful, it brings people in. One concern is that so they have more money, they drive up the costs of rent and goods and services, and the people who already live there get squeezed out. How big a part of the problem is that?
Yeah, it's big. It's really big, right? So, and I don't want to make it seem like there is an obvious, easy answer out there that people just choose not to pick up, because that's not the case. It's very difficult, especially when pretty much all of our land is out in a marketplace, right? To keep prices affordable while also making a more desirable product, right? Because like everything else, as you make things nicer and better, they're going to have more value, and that value is going to be reflected in the cost of rent or the, you know, median house price, right? And so yeah, a lot of the times you become a victim of your own success if you do make your town or your neighborhood or your city, you know, that much better. You're going to have a hard time retaining the people that still live there and let them benefit from that rising tide. Now, one thing that you see that's even more pernicious than that is that oftentimes the increase in land values also undermines the very thing that might make the place desirable in the first place. Is it right? So I think a lot of people, especially if they've lived in a very large city, have experienced this, where a neighborhood that used to be very funky and had like lots of artists and lots of interesting things happening gets noticed. And then the experimental kind of places become coffee shops, and then the coffee shops become art studios or art galleries, and then stuff starts turning into like the Bank of America, and then there's a lot more chain stores, and eventually the thing that was the spark that was there is now gone, and what's replaced it are like chain stores and you know, like expensive lofts. Right. And that's that happens all over the place. And it's a very robust phenomenon. And so that tells us that, you know, that's going to happen absent direct intervention. And there's some tools on the table, but nothing that's used widespread that works 100% of the time.
Another concern, a little more subtle, I think, in your book, David, is who is at the table? Who's deciding what the identity of a community is? Who is doing the outreach? And you suggest, I think, that a lot of people are left out, as you mentioned with the Milwaukee flag debate. What did you see as you looked at those communities in New York?
Yeah. So now I'm gonna be kind of New York specific here, with the one caveat that a lot of states in the United States have something similar to this, right? The jurisdictions will be different. How you get on the various committees will be different, and a bunch of other things. But I'm not fluent in you know, Wisconsin
sure.
Government, but here's what happens in New York, is that there are 10 regional economic development councils that compete with each other sometimes, but mostly carry on competitions parallel to each other within their respective areas, right? And this is good for a place like New York State, where you have obviously New York City, which is much different, much denser, much richer than a Schenectady, a Rochester, or like the southern tier. And so by setting up these parallel competitions, you do get a little bit more democracy in this, or more places get a shot at the big prize, which is lots of state money, either in the form of direct grants or low to no interest loans, is usually the structure of the assistance. And and those grants and loans are spread across lots of different programs that have lots of different goals. Everything from, bolstering the state's agriculture to celebrating the history of the Erie Canal, right? And everything in between. And what happens is usually a city, a nonprofit, or a for-profit business will apply for anywhere from 5 to 7 figures of aid in order to do a certain kind of economic development project. And then the council in each region gets to rate their applications. And who sits on the council are appointed by the governor, and they are almost always the high-level executive or owner or president of a bank, a hospital, or a university are a lot of the big ones. And then there are also, like, large manufacturers if they're in the area, or some sort of large employer, and a couple of successful entrepreneurs, right? But these are appointed by the governor, and they make their decisions, and they make their decisions out in the open. But you could also criticize this as just sort of like taking those smoky backroom backslapping deals and just like, taking meeting minutes. But you haven't changed anything important. You've just kind of like made it a little bit more transparent. But the end result is that, these appointees are picking winners and losers. But in the process, they are trying to say that everyone that they did pick meets some sort of broader goal or vision that the council has articulated. And in that way, we take what we call a market economy and we plan it, right? By region, based on what some of the more powerful actors in that regional economy think the rest of the region should act like or behave like.
And David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's David Banks. His new book is called The City Authentic: How the Attention Economy Builds Urban America.